Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
We are back on the air here at CFAX 1070, taking a look at one of the other stories that we have been following very closely. Two members of J-POD in the news, J-35 as well as J-50 Scarlet. We spoke with representatives from the American National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, about a experiment to try to feed the four-year-old orca J-50, dangerously underweight. Still not sure exactly what happened there. There are more proposed actions being made, though. This crisis situation, 75 southern resident killer whales left in existence. And it's not just the number, because I had somebody point out to me the other day that in terms of the natural fluctuation of this population over the last century, we have been here before in terms of the number. It ebbs and flows for any number of reasons. The problem, though, is that at least as far as I know, we are in the longest uninterrupted time of zero successful births right now than we have been. It is not that the number has fallen to 75. It is that the replacement rate for the last 3 years and counting has fallen to zero. That is what is extremely concerning. So what do we do? Well, according to the David Suzuki Foundation, as well as the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation, the time has come to demand the immediate closure of Chinook fisheries on the British Columbia coast and the closure of all whale watching. I want to bring Misty McDuffie on the show to talk about this, in these actions, what difference they might make. Are they even practical? So many questions. So let's dive in. Misty McDuffie is a biologist and a wild salmon program director at the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation. Good morning. Pleasure as always.
Good morning, Adam.
It's been a difficult few weeks to watch the members of J-POD, Telequa, swimming around for 17 days with her little dead calf on her nose for much of that. J-50, Scarlet, continuing to look more emaciated with the peanut head, the indentation behind her blowhole. What has it been like for you to watch all this?
Yeah, like everybody, it's difficult, and it's especially difficult when animals are suffering, and that was the visible display that was so evident. It's one thing to know the population is in decline. It's another to know that individuals are suffering.
When we talk about actions to try to save these animals, we're at the point now where scientists are becoming much more bold in their attempts to nurse back to health, say, Scarlet J-50, for example. There's less of a fear right now about habituation than there is about just keeping her alive at the moment by trying to feed her live fish and whatnot. In terms of policy change, though, in terms of large transformative change that we could see governments try to undertake, talk about the proposal to close Chinook fisheries immediately and even close whale watching businesses immediately.
Okay, so when we're calling for the Chinook closure, it is marine, commercial, and recreational fisheries. And the reason for that is twofold. Mm-hmm. One is that these mixed stock fisheries are part of the reason that we're in the crisis that we are with Chinook, because they go fishing on mixed populations, many of which can't sustain the harvest rates that they're experiencing, and those populations go into decline. But the problem is that they're not the populations that are driving the exploitation rates, and in many cases in British Columbia, we don't even know the status of many of those runs. So the reason that we are in this situation is because too many wild salmon populations are not making it back to their spawning grounds. So that's one of the things this will do.
Okay.
The second thing is that we catch between 1.5 and 2 million Chinook under the Pacific Salmon Treaty between Canada and the U.S. every year. Now, those mixed stock fisheries are occurring from Southeast Alaska through northern and the west coast of British Columbia. And they are intercepting fish that are headed for either the Salish Sea or to areas that are within the habitat and the range of southern residents. So removing those fisheries and the 500,000 or so fish that those specific fisheries catch should allow those fish to get down into the Salish Sea and to the coast of Washington and Oregon towards their range. So it should immediately, had this been done in the spring, it would immediately improve the abundance and the index of Chinook within those areas that where southern residents could feed on them.
So this isn't just the closure of, say, the sport fishery, which I've been told is far, far smaller, but this is the closing of just all the fisheries for Chinook.
All the marine.
Marine. What's the distinction there, just for our audience's sake?
Okay, so what we're not saying needs to be closed is in-river fisheries and First Nations food and ceremonial fisheries.
Okay.
So this doesn't affect First Nations, and most of those and those in-river fisheries are occurring after killer whales have had access to them. Now, we are making another exception because we think there might be, you know, one or two other places on the coast where they're out of the areas where southern residents would be feeding on them, and they're returning to areas not that won't affect southern residents, and where they do have some evidence that that populations are not in the decline that many others are in. So we're saying that if you can demonstrate that you're meeting escapement goals and they're biologically defendable escapement goals, then that can go ahead.
Okay.
But I can only think of one or two places where that might be right now.
So if we're talking about 1.5 million fish that would normally be brought in, that seems like a rather large economic cost. Do we know what would happen if we actually closed this fishery from an economic point of view?
Well, I mean, it's not easy, but it's not unprecedented. And this is, an initiative that the former West Coast Fisheries Minister David Anderson did for coho in the 1990s. And coho had, you know, clear evidence that it was being overfished.
Mm.
And he closed that coho fishery for 5 years to allow those populations to be rebuilt. And it was successful. So and I should clarify,
yes,
that of the 1.5 to 2 million Chinook that are caught every year, it wouldn't be all of those fish that would be closed. So some of those that catch is part of First Nations food fisheries, and some of that catch is part of in-river fisheries.
Okay.
So that most of the south migrating West Coast, like down the shelf of the West Coast, that would be, you know, probably somewhere around, you know, 500,000 to 750,000 fish.
Okay.
That would be migrating down the West Coast.
Now, you see, down the shelf of the coast, talk about what the fish is actually doing and how the depth of the ocean relates to that.
So these are Chinook that are returning from different places within the North Pacific. So depending on, Chinook are unique and diverse, and there's no one sort of catch-all in terms of how long they spend in fresh water, how long they'll spend in the coastal waters, and how long they'll spend in, like, offshore in deeper waters.
Mm-hmm.
So when those fish reach maturity, they, depending again on the populations, because some of them landfall right back towards the Juan de Fuca, but others will landfall further north, like up into southeast Alaska, and migrate down the coast. And so it's those stocks, and they tend to be later run populations that do that, that landfall coming into southeast Alaska, then they're caught in the troll and the recreational fisheries through southeast Alaska. So those populations in southeast Alaska, 90% of what they catch in those fisheries is destined for rivers within British Columbia and the U.S. Pacific Northwest. So 90% of what's caught in Alaska is heading south.
Okay.
So and then those fish would be migrating, and then, you know, as they're coming into British Columbia, they're going to start to split off. So some of the Chinook returning to the Skeena and the Nass are going to move across, but towards land. But then the others will continue to migrate down the shelf towards their rivers of origin.
Is this something we would need to get the Americans to sign on for, or does Canada have the power to make the substantial change on its own?
We are asking that the U.S. organizations call on the U.S. government to do the same thing. And right now, the negotiations are occurring on Chinook between Canada and the U.S. to sign the treaty for, you know, 10 years again, and that southern resident killer whales aren't even mentioned in this treaty. That is just a fish trading agreement between Canada and the U.S., and this treaty needs to be much more conservation-based than it is. So we do need to collaborate cross-border for these measures.
Now, who has responsibility over the U.S. part of that treaty? Is it state or is it federal U.S. government?
It's both.
Okay.
So So the state and the federal government are involved in those negotiations.
Because I'm thinking, you know, the Governor Inslee, quite sort of pro-environmental, pro-conservation, I could see him signing on. Donald Trump, on the other hand, that administration, I could see there being some problems.
Yeah, I think it hasn't been easy to get to where they are with the treaty negotiations. And, you know, they're not going to want to hear these kinds of things, but they have to recognize that the treaty has failed and that we need to start putting these kind of initiatives on the table.
I want to take a quick break. Misty McDuffie talking about two, and they are very bold proposals being made. Our guest says they are a reflection of the critical nature of the situation itself. 75 Southern resident killer whales left. It's not just the number, though, folks. It's that the replacement rate has gone to zero. There have been zero new babies that have survived, born in the last 3 years and counting. There's another recommendation being made. It has to do with whale watching. We'll talk about that, as well as take calls, questions, comments, 250-386-1161. We're back right after this.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Precedent exists, according to our guest, Misty McDuffie, biologist and wild salmon program director with Raincoast Conservation Foundation. It was David Anderson, former federal environment minister, also the member of parliament for Victoria for a number of years, closed down the coho fishery back in the 90s for 5 years. Misty McDuffie, when the coho fishery got shut down, did it produce the impacts we were seeking?
In terms of recovery of coho?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So it worked.
It did.
So how much disruption did it cost? Because that's what I'm thinking here. Like, how many billion dollars are going to be lost? How many jobs are going to be lost? We see benefits, but what is the cost?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that because there are four other species of salmon, that the effort really shifts over to that.
Okay.
That's where the effort would go.
How do they determine what type they catch? How does that work?
What type of salmon that they're targeting?
Yeah. How does that work, just for our audience's sake?
Yeah, well, that's some of the problem, is that you're targeting specific runs, but they're often co-migrating with other either species or populations.
Okay.
And it's the bycatch of those other species or populations that has caused the problems for marine fisheries.
Gotcha.
And that's why we are such an advocate for terminal in-river fisheries. So we know where the fisheries occur once the fish have actually reached the river that they plan on spawning in. And so you know the abundance then, and then you can slowly, fish that run, go fishing, let more fish through, go fishing, let more fish through, so that you're not affecting the run timing and you're taking a rate that is reflective of how many fish you know are there, or you have a better idea that are there.
I want to ask you about whale watching. Closure of all whale watching is what it says here on the press release. Does that mean closure of the whale watching business in general? What does that mean?
No, so that's specifically for southern resident killer whales.
Okay.
And what we had asked in our earlier petition, the one that we'd put in front of the federal government, was that they close the areas that scientists identified needed to be closed as foraging areas for the whales. And we had originally asked that if you're going to close those areas from fishing, it only makes sense, because the reason you're closing them is the disruption that the vessel noise and the presence has on the ability to successfully feed for the whales. So if you're going to close those areas, you also need to close them to whale watching as well. And they didn't do that. So, again, putting all the burden onto the fishing sector. So what we're hoping, and the interesting thing is that some of the really progressive companies within the Pacific Whale Watching Association are already making an effort to not whale watch on southern residents. So they're shifting their effort towards the big transient killer whales and the humpback whales. And some companies are either have already pledged to not view southern resident killer whales, and others are trying to avoid them. So, and because of the lack of southern residents in the Salish Sea over the last year or two, many companies are shifting that way anyways.
I see. So, just because there's more. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So so that's what we're asking them to do. Now, the most egregious violators, and the PWWA, the Pacific Whale Watching Association, would agree with this, are the private vessels. And this is where the third piece of what we're asking is that DFO get out there on the water and enforce some regulations, because, you know, all of us have got stories where we're watching private operators within, you know, I saw them last week within 100 meters of Southern residents as they're moving up Pender Island. And no one is around other than the people on shore yelling at them to say, you know, you're violating the law and you're disrupting these whales. And So even the 200-meter regulation isn't worth anything if there's nobody out there to enforce it. And again, that's what we're calling on the federal government to do, is to get out there.
How,
on the water.
So, and the whale watchers, they can tell the difference between the transients and the residents just by looking, yes?
Correct.
Okay. 250-386-1161. Let's go to Dennis. Dennis, you're on the air with Misty McDuffie. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a sport fisherman, and have been for a long time, but I guess the elephant maybe in the room is nobody's discussing the sea lions and seals. And in your Times columnist a little while ago, it noted 1970, there was approximately 68 tons of Chinook eaten by the seals. 2015, there was 625 tons.
Wow.
So that's quite an increase.
Absolutely. Let's get our guests to respond to that. Dennis, thank you so much. Misty McDuffie, what role are alternate predators having diminishing the salmon run, such as seals and sea lions?
Yeah, I think that we have to better elucidate that. I think that there's two places where having a better understanding of the impact that they're having is, one is the ability of, you know, are they feeding on adults, because, you know, everybody sort of sees the visual when a sea lion pulls a salmon off a line or out of a net.
Yeah.
But then the other piece is as juveniles, and, you know, that's something that we need a greater handle on. But the interesting thing, like definitely seals have recovered in the Salish Sea since the 1970s when the marine mammal regulations came into effect, but they generally tapered off around 2000, and since then, the frequency of those mammal-eating killer whales has increased in the Salish Sea. So that population hasn't been growing for a while.
Interesting.
And those transients, big killer whales, may be even pushing down those numbers as well. Hmm. But definitely seals and sea lions are bold, and they have, there's no repercussions for them to pull a salmon off of a line or out of a net, and there's no doubt that they are doing it.
Yeah.
The extent of the problem, I think we need a better understanding of.
So if we started shooting the seals, we risk starving the transient killer whales.
Yeah, the thing with shooting seals is that killing those kind of calls are generally ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, whether it's scaring away a seal from a net or a hook may not be a bad thing. But in terms of thinking that culling them and killing them will change this, it likely won't.
Okay.
But there also may be specific places where we've given seals and sea lions an advantage, like log booms at the mouths of rivers and places where predators could have historically gotten to that they don't now. And so, you know, humans have helped shift that balance as well. So I think that in the places where we have aided their predation and their presence, that we should address that.
Let's go to Dwight. Dwight, you're on the air with Misty McDuffie. Go ahead, please.
I just have a question on that. You talk about all the fisheries and everything. I haven't heard anybody talk about or discuss the lost drift nets that are out there that fill up, sink, fish that are caught in them rot, and then they float back up and catch a bunch more. Is that out there?
Good question, Dwight. Thank you. Misty?
Yeah, those are ghost nets, and it's a good question, and the extent of the problem... there's not evidence that salmon are getting caught in those ghost nets. Other species probably more likely, but it's a good question, and it would be good to have a good answer to it.
Misty McDuffie, let's go to one more call, then we'll wrap this up. Greg, it's going to be you. Go ahead.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good.
I want to know one thing. Is you talk a lot about the industry and and the amount of fish that that people are taking, like commercial fishing. And I want to know why you haven't mentioned the food chain for the salmon. You never seem to mention that. And we have a problem with the food chain, with the plankton and the smolt eating the plankton, and then the smolt mm-hmm. growing up, and and then the amount of herring that is being taken, which is the primary food for Chinook. Hmm. Why do you never talk about that? Because we have a huge problem there, where the commercial fishing industry is taking large, because they have such good technology, they can go in and take a whole school of herring, and all they're taking it for is the roe, and it's being shipped to China. Well, I want to know why you haven't targeted any of your efforts on that.
Well, let's ask Misty. Herring, should that be what we're focusing on?
I think that we should be. I agree with the caller, and I think we should be ramping up our efforts on herring.
They are bold calls for action, but we find ourselves in dire times. Misty McDuffie, thanks for coming on the show. Any final thoughts?
My pleasure. And I agree with what you were saying about that it's not the actual number. But the other thing that's likely happened since that we were at these low numbers in the past is the decline in the quality of habitat within the Salish Sea. So that's probably the thing that's making the difference this time.
Misty McDuffie, we will follow this story. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye now. Misty McDuffie is biologist, wild salmon program director, Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Yes, disruptive, bold calls for action. Maybe it'll save the whales, though. We will follow this and see if government wants to actually enact any of these policies.